So yes, our topic is indeed Yisro and in-law relationships in the Torah. So happy birthday. And okay. Clashes between in-laws are not a new thing. They're not, they go way back. We'll see, they go back into Tanakh itself. But I wanted to just show you two interesting examples of this that are found in the Gemara. One of them deals with a morbid issue. The issue is testifying that a man has passed away so that his wife will be able to remarry. And we're told that everybody's allowed to testify. Everybody's credible. Men, women, doesn't make a difference, except for the following five people. That's the Mishnah in source number one. And who are the people who are ineligible? So the first one on the list is her mother-in-law. The idea being that potentially the husband has not passed away. However, if the mother-in-law is not a fan of the daughter-in-law, and she testifies that the husband has in fact died, and then the wife goes in, gets involved with somebody else, that will sabotage the relationship with her son, and that's a motive. And it's apparently a serious enough motive that disqualifies her from testifying. Also others on this list, each one with their own motivation, some of them more clear, some of them less clear. But that already tells you that the Mishnah is aware of strife between mother-in-law, daughter-in-law. Other example is in number two, and this is dealing with a little bit of an esoteric issue. It's the issue of Erev Chatzeros. Anyone familiar with Erev Chatzeros by chance?
No,
what
is
it? Okay.
Oh, what is it? Erev Chatzeros is an Erev, right?
Yes,
so
and no.
Within a building, within a courtyard.
I mean, right. So the deal is this. From the Torah, you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos from a public domain into a private domain, private into public. But let's say I have a house with a backyard, and the backyard is fenced in, and then my neighbor, also backyard, it's fenced in, they're independently private areas, and the question is, we have a gate between the two yards, would you be allowed to carry something through that gate from private into private? Maybe all right, so I'm luckily sure. There's nothing wrong with that. It's private into private. They're adjacent. You didn't go through any other area. It's fine. However, midrabanan, we don't allow that. Midrabanan, you're not allowed to carry from private into private either, with a workaround, which is called Eru Chatzeros. And what Eru Chatzeros means is you set up a meal. The meal is, you know, basic, I mean, bread. The meal is accessible to both parties. It's considered to be owned by both of them. It's placed in one of the yards. And the fact that you have that meal enables you to carry between them on Shabbos. They've been merged. Erev means a merger, a mixture.
You broke bread together, you're now like related. Right?
Exactly. You're uniting your properties.
If you're like in a complex of some sort where like everyone, like all the houses have like shared ownership of like a big fenced
like
area,
a
that's right, or even like
oh,
subdivisions wow. that are
right.
A gated community,
right.
That's what I mean.
Right. So that can, depending a little bit on how the ownership is structured and the areas
right.
are structured, that can be relevant there as well. You have one in Toronto. I mean, because what you do when you have what we call the Erev, right, boundary marked around the city, everything is enclosed in what's really called a Tzuras HaPesach. Essentially, it's a set of doorways that are adjacent to each other, doorways, walls, you know, sea and rail, what's the word I'm looking for? Inclines, you know, all the different ways in which the so-called Eruv works fundamentally would not be effective if not for the fact that there is also a jointly owned meal that is accessible theoretically to everybody. You have to know where it is, which merges all of the private properties around the city into being one. That's the way it works, so that all the private areas that are within it are merged for this purpose.
But there is public areas within that.
There are public areas, well, not a Rishus HaRab.
You and your neighbor.
Not a Rishus HaRab. There's what you're accomplishing with your Eruv is converting the quasi-public, the Karmelis, as we call it, areas into private areas. That's what you're doing. And there's more to be said, but that's basically the way that it works. So this meal is accessible to everybody, and it merges the property into one big domain. So that rule that rule that you create this merged property only works if everybody is in. What if one of the residents of one of the yards decides, I'm not in, I don't want to be a part of this, does not participate? It can actually disqualify the whole Eruv, so that no one is able to carry if somebody is out. And that's the discussion here in the Gemara. And all of this is just background for like one line, but it's worth it. The Mishnah says, Haminiach beisov ahalach lishbos bi'ir acheres. If somebody leaves his house and says, I'm going somewhere else for Shabbos, he still owns the house. He just decides, I'm staying elsewhere, and does not participate in the Eruv meal, does not contribute to it, is not part of it. So Rabbi Shimon, there's a whole discussion about it, and Rabbi Shimon takes the view that if you leave your home, but you go to stay in the general vicinity with your daughter, then you're not considered to be a member of that community that's within the Eruv anymore, because you're not there for Shabbos. You're staying with your daughter, right? So in other words, if you were considered to be part of this little area, the private, you know, the private yards, then you would have to contribute to the Eruv, but the whole thing is no good. However, if you're staying a little bit away, even though you could walk home, it's local, nonetheless, you go to stay with your daughter, and therefore, you're not considered to be part of this area. You're with your daughter for Shabbos. You follow?
That's because of what they used to pay on a weekly basis?
Yeah, they used to actually create it on a weekly basis. People actually ate the meal.
Every week?
Yeah.
Because it was that important.
Or because you're supposed to do it every week. There's a big machlokas about how often you have to renew the Eruv Chatzeros. Okay. But the ideal was certainly that every Friday they would actually create this all over again. We don't do it that way. We tend to do it as a once-a-year thing. Usually before Pesach, they get matzah and they
create
it
that
way. Yeah, usually it's in a shul, you know, that kind of thing. There's some discussion about what kind of space it has to be in, what if the space is locked, and so on. But the idea here is, let's say, make it practical, let's say you wanted to have an Eruv Chatzeros somewhere in this area, and you had somebody who had one of the yards that you were trying to merge, and they had a daughter living in, I don't know, the Clayton Park area, and they went there for Shabbos. Rabbi Shimon is saying, by going there to your daughter for Shabbos, that means you're no longer a resident here, and therefore you don't have to contribute to the Eruv Chatzeros. That's the idea. So in the Gemara, they say the halacha follows Rabbi Shimon. However, that works only if you go to your daughter. If you go to your son, then there's a risk that you might actually come home during Shabbos. That's what the Gemara says.
Davkavita.
No love, but not if it's your son. Why? Da Amri Inshi, as people say, Navach Bach Kalba, if a male dog barks at you, don't worry about it. Oh, go in. Dog, yeah, the male dog, all bark, no bite. Navach Bach Guryasa, but on the other hand, if it's the female, poke, then you better leave. And the issue here that they're talking about is the son's wife. It's the son's wife, the daughter-in-law. That's the issue. So I bring you all of this. It took us a while to get to the punchline. But
and what, Yichud at all or not?
Sorry.
Does it have to do with Yichud at all?
No. Nothing to do with Yichud at all. Everything to do with the nature of in-law relationships. Mm-hmm. That's what this is about. And it tells us that, yes, back in the time of the Gemara, both of these sources, number one and number two, show us that that in-law issues were alive and well back then, and as we're going to see, it's throughout Tanakh as well. I know some of you told me that you took up the challenge of my email and tried to find a case of a positive parent-in-law relationship in Tanakh. There is at least one, but it's way outnumbered. It's way outnumbered. But we'll get to it.
Well, Moshe and Yisro was very
nice.
So we're going to get to Moshe and Yisro.
That's not what the... It was the other gender.
I know, and I'm so excited.
That's okay. That's still an in-law relationship.
Right.
So,
I'm thinking straight.
So we're going to see. But in Moshe's relationship with Yisro, we are going to see ways that relationships, in-law relationships, can work, despite the presence of potential pitfalls, as we're going to see. The side note...
A father-in-law and a son-in-law.
It's different than...
Potentially, at least based on that line. Based on that line. So take a look, first of all, at number three. Number three is a capsule of Yisro's arrival that's recorded in the beginning of Parshas Yisro. So you remember back in Parshas Shmos, right? Moshe ran away to Midian. He went to the well. He fought off the people who were harassing Yisro's daughters. The daughters come home. Yisro says to them, what happened? You're here. You got back so fast. And they say, well, yeah, this Egyptian man saved us. And he says, well, where is he? Invite him home. They invite him in, and he ends up staying, and he marries Tzipora. He is there for a very long time, with a possible detour in Ethiopia, as the Medrash records, but it's only when he's 80 that he ends up going back to Mitzrayim. And initially, it sounds like he's going to bring his family, but in the end, his family is in Midian. That's its own discussion, but his family stays in Midian. His family misses the whole Sound and Light show. They miss all the Makos. They miss Yamsuf. All of that, they don't experience. You know, you sort of imagine, like, Moshe gets to see Tzipora, and she asks, so how have you been? And he's like, well, do you have a little while?
Weren't his babies on the way? Is it their first on the way?
Yes, but then they don't end up being in, they're not within the Amazon, they're back in Midian, yeah. This is the whole thing in Aaron. Says to him, why are you bringing more Jews here to suffer? We already have enough suffering. So take a look at source number 3. This is the beginning of our parsha. The English comes off of the JPS 1985 translation. So we get Jethro. Yisro, the Kohen Midian, the priest of Midian, Moshe's father-in-law, hears everything that Hashem has done for Moshe and for the Jews. Hashem has taken us out of Egypt. And Yisro takes Tzipora, Moshe's wife, achar shilucheha, after she had been sent home. Right, keep in mind the whole discussion about Moshe's marriage with Tzipora, whether they were divorced, was there not a divorce. The word shiluchin is a suggestive word regarding divorce, but that's not our topic today. So he takes Tzipora, as well as their two sons, Gershom and Eliezer. And in Pasuk A, sentence 5, although the English doesn't have the numbers, it's the second paragraph, Yisro comes to Moshe along with Gershom and Eliezer, and they're camped at Har HaElokim at Har Sinai, and he says to Moshe, I guess by messenger, right? Because, well, number one, it's a very strange message to send otherwise. You say, I am your father-in-law. You know, I mean, you'd hope he'd recognize him. But also, it's clear in the next pasuk that this is being done by messenger. He sends a message to Moshe saying, I, Yisro, have arrived along with your wife and two sons. So Moshe goes to greet his father-in-law. That's how you know the first message was sent by messenger. He said, Moshe goes out to greet him, he bows, he kisses him, they ask, hi, how are you doing? They come to Moshe's tent, Moshe tells his father-in-law everything that has been going on, all the travails of the road as well. Remember they were attacked by Amalek, right? They had to get water, they used the wood to turn the water sweet, then you have the rock that he's supposed to talk to, he got man out of Shemayim. Moshe tells him all of these things, and possibly more, as we'll see. And how Hashem has saved them. And Yisro is thrilled. Yisro is ecstatic about all the good that Hashem has done to the Jews, how Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. And Yisro says, Baruch Hashem, that's amazing. Hashem saved you from Mitzrayim, Hashem saved you from Paro. Now I know Hashem is greater than any other God. It really should be Elohim, probably. This is called it's a reference to the Avodah Zarah. God is greater than all of these gods. And the next words are subject to some debate. Ki ba davar asher zadu alehem. So some take that to mean that Hashem punished the Egyptians measure for measure. Ba davar asher zadu alehem, in the way that the Egyptians had attacked the Jews, that's how Hashem punished the Egyptians. So Yisro then brings karbanos to Hashem, and Aaron and all of the elders come to eat with Yisro before God. Next day, Moshe goes to judge the nation. He still has a day job, and the nation is there morning to night with Moshe taking care of them. Dot, dot, dot. Yisro sees it, and he says, that's no good. It's going to destroy you. It's going to destroy the nation. This is a terrible idea. Here's what you should do. You should have a structure where you'll have levels of judges, there's a hierarchy, and you deal with the top cases, the cases that nobody else can deal with. But it's silly that you're hearing all of the little disputes that somebody else could be taking care of. It's not good for you, it's not good for them. Moshe listens, does everything that his father-in-law told him to do, and then, as we said, sends Yisro home. That's your Yeah.
Why in Pasuk Yudbet is he referred to as Yitro Chatan Moshe? Like, we know already who he is.
Right. So it could be because it's a function of the relationship. In other words, the fact that he brings the karbanos is somehow connects to a relationship. But it's one of those things, you find that in the Torah off and on, that somebody will be identified via relationship in the middle of nowhere. And you know, you can come up with nice explanations, but you never really know. So there's a classic debate, which we're not really going to get into in any depth, as to when this story happened. Right? Does this story happen where it looks like it's happening, which is to say after the war with Amalek and before we received the Torah? Or is this story happening much later on, after Matan Torah? Right? It's really not clear. What argument could you make just from based on the psukim to indicate one or the other?
So what happened already?
Sorry?
Says which events have happened or to be told about. So,
well, he does list certain things. He doesn't list Matan Torah.
Right, so we're saying it was before.
Right, it sounds like it's before Matan Torah, because you'd think that would have been one of the things that was mentioned. That sounds like it should be before Matan Torah. If it's before Matan Torah, how is Moshe judging the people all day? What's he doing?
Any fights that come up.
Yeah, but what system of law is he using? But just going to go with Egyptian law. Right, but it's fairly clear that the Jews at large at this stage don't have anything but the most basic elements of Torah. And without that, you'd say, then why have Matan Torah at all? You can make the argument, Matan Torah, that Hashem will speak to them, but it seems fairly clear in the Psukim themselves, Sham Sam Lachoku Mishpat, so they got some things at Mara. Maybe they did get some kind of laws that will govern relationships. You can make the argument, but there are other problems.
But what exactly is he judging? Everything is given to them. They have all their food. They don't have to work for anything.
You think we can't come up with something? I mean... Yes, but people will always find something to fight.
But also, if he listens to towards the end, when he listens to Yitro's ideas, so maybe that's an indication that it wasn't yet.
It wasn't solidified yet.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, Moshe would have known what he's supposed to do. Could be. How about the fact that Yitro, at the end of this story, goes home? Yitro goes home at the end of this story.
Right. At a certain point, he moves in.
Right, because in Parshas Baal Oscha, when the Jews are about to leave Har Sinai and travel towards Israel, Yisro says, it's time for me to leave. If Yisro already left, when did he come back? We have no record of that. Now, that's not the end of the world. There are lots of things we don't have a record of. But it's strange that he would suddenly be back, and we didn't know it.
Also, isn't there like some sort of, I don't know if there's psukim surrounding this, maybe it's just medrash that he hears what happens at Matan Torah, and that's what makes him come.
So it's possible. I mean, we're going to see. There's the other point of view. The other point of view is that it's post Matan Torah, and then Vayishma Yisro could be that he heard about Matan Torah. Obviously, the major weakness of that answer is then why is this recorded before Matan Torah? So whether Yisro ever converts is actually extremely unclear. That's part of the problem is we don't know whether Yisro ever converts to Judaism. It's not clear. You can find sources that indicate one way, you can find sources that indicate the other way. But yes, you could theoretically say that. That raises another problem. Are you going to tell me that Tzipora and Moshe's kids weren't at Matan Torah? And therefore, they'd have to convert after. They'd have to go through some process afterwards. Sorry, Nechama.
Why did he leave?
Why did Yisro leave at this point?
Yeah.
Well, if he's not converting, it's he has no reason to hang out there. I mean, the Jews are not going to have a great time in the Midbar, even with the man.
So why is he coming here? To bring his daughter and grandchildren?
Well, it is nice. You know, they'd like to see their husband and father. You know.
These are kids twice, like once with Moshe and once with Yisro, and it doesn't mention Matan Torah. Like, it just can't be that they're just glossing over this major event that already happened.
And that's a realistic view. Flip the page, please. Number 4. Gemara in Zvach. I just brought you a piece of the Gemara. There's a whole other discussion there about the karbanos he brought and whether a non-Jew could have brought those karbanos. But the Gemara in Zvachim, Vayishma Yisro Kohen Midyan, Mashmua Shama Uba Vinnis Gayer, supporting Aviva's suggestion that Yisro in fact did convert. What was it that he heard that he came to convert? So Rabbi Yeshua says, Lachemas Amalek Shama, he heard about the war with Amalek. It's right there, by Achalosh Yoshua, right? Right before this in the Torah was the war with Amalek. Rabbi Lazar Modoi Omer Matan Torah Shama Uba. Rabbi Lazar Modoi says no. He heard about the giving of the Torah, as Dasi suggested. The Sheikh Shenitna Torah Yisrael Hayar Kolo Holech Misofa Olam Viat Sofo, because everybody heard when the Torah was given. Both views are presented here within the Gemara. You can go back and forth for a very long time about this issue and not have any resolution. The in a separate shiur that I'm giving, which shiur is it? I don't remember. of course it's the shiur this afternoon. That was good. The Shmuel shiur, we're learning about the war with Amalek and how first Shaul sends the message to the Cani, who are living next to Amalek, to leave. Right? There, and in the course of that discussion, Radak makes the comment that actually this story here in Yisro and the story in Baal Oscha are the same story. This story here and the one in Baal Oscha are the same story. Sorry? Cani is Yisro. That's why it becomes relevant there. But the idea that Radak presents is that really Yisro shows up after Matan Torah with Tzipora and Moshe's kids and all. They're there after the Torah is given, and he only leaves once, which is this part that's recorded here, which is discussed also in Baal Oscha, and that's why they end up living near Amalek, because they've left. His family, his kids, they effectively get to Canaan separate from the body of the Jewish people. And in terms of why this is here then, he makes a point which I noticed years ago and thought it was interesting, so he actually suggests it, which is that Yisro is meant to be juxtaposed with Amalek because they're opposites. Amalek hears what Hashem has done and comes to attack us. And therefore Hashem says, I'm going to punish them across time. Yisro hears what Hashem has done and comes to join us, and Hashem says, I'm going to reward him across time, as seen with what happens with the Cani later on. Hashem takes care of them in the merit of Yisro. And it's true, you can find multiple times, like the story in Shmuel, in the 15th chapter in Shmuel, you find that, again, Yisro, the Cani, and Amalek are side by side. It happens a few times in Tanakh. So, in any case, that's a side note. The bottom line here is, it's not clear when they showed up.
Who sides with Radak says that he was not by Matzitar? Who sides with...
You already see a view among the Tanaim here in the Gemara in Zvachim. But it's a bigger discussion. Look at Rashi and Ramban. I think that there's a debate there between them, but I'm not sure. I'm just mentioning it as an aside. I wasn't going to make that the focus of where we're going
here. All converts that were there, like, the Gerim were there, wasn't Israel representing all the Gerim, like, for generations to come or something?
Wow, it's a nice idea. I don't know. Right, well, no, because you're pointing to a different question, which is the question of, if all Jews are supposed to have been in Matan Torah, what about those who converted? So one answer is, I think it's the Chasam Sofer, that their neshama was present as well. But it could be the suggested, I suppose, that he's somehow the representative. But go back to number three, this whole story with Yisro showing up. The story seems really positive here, right? Positive in terms of the relationship with Moshe, positive in terms of his connection to Hashem. Right? By the way, you should really cut the cake for people, because it's just sitting there. If you look at Pasuk Yud Beis, well, you can't look at Pasuk Yud Beis, actually. No, there it is. It is there. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Pasuk Yud Beis, or in the English, it's the next last paragraph. You find that he brings korbanos to Hashem, right? So that's a good sign that Yisro is bringing korbanos. He has a feast with Moshe and with Aaron. You know, seems to be getting along just fine. Advises Moshe about how Moshe can help the nation run. Which, a complete aside, but worth noting, right? You would have thought Moshe, being Moshe, would have understood the need to delegate. Right, the need to create a hierarchy of courts. So the Mefarshim asked that question of, like, I mean, if for nothing else, then that Moshe grew up in Paro's palace. Did he not know how government worked? you can't possibly think that everybody came to Paro in Mitzrayim with all their problems. So they give different answers, but if you look at this week's Tanya Torah by Weintraub, the Parsha article he addressed, it had a very creative approach to what it was that Yisro was doing, and how, in fact, Moshe does it a little bit differently from what Yisro says, which is why when the story about the creation of this hierarchy of judges is told again in Parshas Devarim, Yisro's role is not mentioned. It just says that Moshe sets up all these judges and say anything about doing it on Yisro's advice, because actually it was different. What Moshe does is not quite what Yisro does. Sorry?
He was just giving him honor.
Yes. But take a look at Toronto Torah this week and you'll see it there.
But was he actually judging, or was it more of like a guidance, therapy, friend, mentor?
But what Moshe was doing?
Yeah. Okay.
It sounds like he's judging, really.
Yeah,
that really does. Even though it's hard, again, for us to understand exactly what that looked like.
Well,
especially for the form of the book. Precisely. But in any case,
has to be the very next morning?
What do you mean?
When does Matan Torah happen? In between,
those two? Theoretically, I suppose. It would be very strange.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it's strange in general. We're not talking about it, but yeah.
Right, but now we're saying not that this was before, not that this was after, but actually it was during.
Well, the Matan Torah usually means there's something major that happened before.
Well, that
can be.
I don't know.
I hear the possibility, I'm just.
It's
sorry.
A little strange, but it fits. It just makes everything fit properly. If they don't talk about it before, it didn't happen, and now he's judging because it's after.
I hear you.
Do we have a question?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm just pointing out that everything looks really good in the relationship between Moshe and Yisro. That's really what I wanted to show you at this stage. I also brought you the Or Chaim, which was from that shiur in Chayei Sarah, because it makes the comment that we introduced this story with Yisro specifically about the judicial hierarchy to show that we don't have the monopoly on brains. That we got this great idea, not through ourselves, but actually through Yisro, which works better if we assume that what Moshe did was actually what Yisro told him to do. But in any case, how common is this kind of relationship between the in-laws we find in a Tanakh? The answer is rare. I thought that I might just give you a list here of the relationships. And then I thought, no, that's too easy. Give me the relationships, the in-law relationships that don't work out that you can think of in Tanakh. I thought of some. I'm sure there are some I did not think of. I'm not counting relationships where the Torah doesn't give us any information. Meaning, I don't know anything about Terach's relationship with Sarah. I'm not going to assume it was good. I'm not going to assume it was bad. I don't know anything about it.
And you want, like, with a woman? Or
no, man or woman, parent-in-law, child-in-law. Okay, so Lavan and Yaakov is definitely on the bad side. In terms of these relationships. What else?
Shaul
and David, right? Shaul twice over, right? Because Shaul first, after David kills Goliath, is supposed to give Merav to David, but he doesn't want to. He ends up marrying off Merav to somebody else. Then he marries off Michal to David, tries to use that as a means of killing David, right? Does not succeed. David ends up fleeing. He ends up giving Michal to Palti ben Laish, or trying to. At any rate, that's a really bad relationship.
You want a good relationship?
No, we'll get to a good one. So Ruth and Naomi is... Ruth and Naomi, was that the one you had?
One of them,
okay. So Ruth and Naomi is a nice, positive relationship. Although, I'm going to go back to that one.
Yeah, it wasn't all positive.
What do you mean it wasn't all positive?
I remember once hearing this year where it's like, where actually the relationship wasn't that... Rosie, where Naomi kind of forced Ruth to do certain things.
Well, I guess she did set her up.
I'm trying to remember.
I wouldn't call it negative in that sense. I would point out two things about that relationship. Number one, halachically, they're not mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, because at the time that Ruth marries Naomi's son, she's not Jewish. She can't. Because we learn laws of conversion from that whole speech that she gives when they come back to Israel, right? After Orpah says, "I'm not going," right? After Orpah leaves.
Any laws before? Then how could she be violating them?
No, we learn what we do. What do you mean there were no laws before?
If that's where we learn the laws,
No. I'm saying that we learn, like, some... I don't mean laws like that. I mean, like, the things that we say to somebody who wants to convert, we draw from Amecha Ami, Elokai Elokai, you know, and all that. How can you do that if that's not a conversion speech? I understand that it's very difficult to accept this idea that Rus married the Machlon or Kilion when we're Jewish.
But, like, after the fact.
Maybe. The Gemara Yavamos doesn't seem to think so.
Oh,
no.
I don't know.
The Gemara Yavama seems to think that they convert, that Rus only converts at this stage. They, I'm sure there's another point of view. I'm sure there's another point of view. But that's, well, because halachically, she's not her daughter-in-law. That's correct. The other thing that's interesting there is that there's an element of replacement going on, because Rus has the child, but Naomi raises the child. Right? If you think that's not a recipe for in-law problems. I'm just noting. But yes, you're right. That's one of the positive ones. Okay. Can you give me any other relationships, positive or otherwise?
Yehuda and Tamar.
Yehuda and Tamar. You call that one a negative relationship. And then it becomes a weird relationship. but it's a negative one. Because Yehuda withholds Shela from marrying Tamar. Ramban criticizes him for withholding Shela. His third son.
But
wasn't
she marrying her if it was a negative relationship?
And also, wasn't she willing to do anything to save him from being embarrassed? I thought.
I mean, he didn't know, but sorry.
She was willing to do anything to save him from embarrassment. So.
So she is good to him.
Yeah,
and
yes.
I don't see it. So negative.
I thought it was negative, and he owns that relationship.
Okay. Well, we don't get enough information about relationship, except that the Torah says, "Lo yasafo l'data." He never is with her again. Yeah. Sorry, Aviva. What?
He owns up and he's good to her.
I mean, good to her in the sense that he saves her life from, you know, his act. I mean, it's hard to paint that as heroism. I mean, we do say, yes, it's true. He admits it publicly, but you look at it and think, well, how could you not admit it publicly? You see her killed for, yes, I shouldn't do. It's hard to sustain that. I'm not. That's not my own comment. That's a Medrash that talks about when it was that Yehuda was a hero and says it's not that story. It's the story with Yosef where he stands up for Binyamin. But what other relationships do we know of? I still have a few more.
If you're David, well, that was a very short one. David, he would look when he's looking for somebody was telling you this. David, there were two statues, one of Yitzchak and one of Yaakov, to commemorate the bris that Avimelech had with them. So he said, whoever knocks down these statues, I will give them my child to this person. David and something?
Wow. I'm not familiar. That doesn't mean it's not so. I'm not familiar with it. But who is the person?
I don't know.
Okay. So until then, I won't know what the in-law relationship is.
Yeah, future
but
in-law.
Other Chumash relationships, Rivka and Esav's wives, right? Batiana Boaz Ruach Yitzchak Ulu Rivka. So it's not just Rivka, it's Yitzchak also, the truth of the matter is. But they make Rivka and Yitzchak bitter. We understand, you know, via Rashi, that's because of their Avodah Zarah. But we just know that they make things bitter for Yitzchak and Rivka. How about Manoach and Shimshon's Plishti wife? Right? Shimshon marries a Plishti woman. He comes to his father and says, I want to marry her. She is good in my eyes. And as Rabag says, and others say, she converted to Judaism. She's not still a Plishti. Nonetheless, Manoach says, you can do better. He does not want Shimshon to marry her. And then there's one that I mentioned, even though it's cheating a little bit, and that is that Yosef marries whom?
Oh,
Asnat, who is described in the Torah as the daughter of?
Potiphar.
In the Torah. Daughter of Potiphar and Potipharah, who were, of course, his boss, who threw him in jail. His mother-in-law was the one who had done what she did. Now, it's cheating because she did that before she became his mother-in-law. He only marries after he gets out of jail. So that's why it's cheating. It's not, but I do think that the family dinners probably would have been interesting. You know, on the whole, I think that, that's difficult. And of course, in the Medrash, it's Asnat. It's not Potiphera, but Potiphera was the one who raised Asnat. And either way, it's still a very difficult, difficult relationship. When you go into Medrash, you get some more interesting ones. The Medrash about Bisuel wanting to kill Eliezer in order to get Yitzchak's wealth, right? Bisuel ends up dying, right? So they didn't get a chance to have a relationship. But it's a father-in-law who tries to impoverish his future son-in-law Yitzchak. And then Batsheva tells Shlomo that his wives aren't good enough in the last parak in Mishlei, right? Addressed to Lemuel, who we understand is Shlomo. Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Ayin talks about this, that the parak that you're familiar with is Eishes Chayil has 10 psukim before it, and it's the criticism of Lemuel's mother to him about basically his social life. About it's about not drinking wine, and it's
that
about
whose mother?
Shlomo.
Shlomo.
Yeah. So Batsheva tells Shlomo all about his wives. And then one more case that's not in Tanakh, Kalba Savua. Right? Kalba Savua, who in the version of the relationship between Rachel and Rabbi Akiva and Kalba Savua that appears in the Gemara in Ksuvos, he disowns his daughter Rachel for marrying Rabbi Akiva. So there's another one that doesn't work out. That's not Tanakh. Nonetheless, it's worth noting. There's a different version of the story in the Gemara in Nedarim, but that's the version in Ksuvos. You don't really get great ones. The only one I could come up with that was positive was this Naomi and Rus one. Nechama, you said you had another one?
No, those were the two that I was thinking. Naomi and Yehuda and Tamar.
Oh, Yehuda and Tamar.
I was thinking the positive.
Right, okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. But, So the big question that you have to ask, sorry.
No, it's just like there's no guidance for this sort of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, I think there is some guidance to be drawn from the Moshe and Yisro story, but this is true globally, meaning even though there are lessons that you can learn from stories that appear in Tanakh, I find it very hard to really say about any of these relationships that the Torah is presenting you with a model. Ditto parent-child relationships. We find a lot of destructive ones, and in the good ones, we don't get a lot of information. The truth of the matter is, what you often find is people have certain ideas about how relationships should work, and then they'll find an example of that in the Torah. But there could be 10 other counterexamples that they're not going to bring. Like I
maybe there's just something that we're halachically obligated for kibbutz avim. So I'm wondering, like, there's no discussion of how that fits with in-laws.
There is.
We have all the stories and all the relationship guidance. Like, we still have that mitzvah. We don't have the mitzvah.
But we do.
We do have a mitzvah of honoring in-laws. We're going to get to it.
I think like a Rambam mitzvah or like a...
Yes, like a... Right. You'll see, we're getting to it.
It must come from somewhere.
So...
But maybe it's just not... I mean, this sounds weird. Like, it's not worth the words. If the relationship is all good, then the story is not compelling. Like, usually the stories that we hear are all very complicated dramas. Mm-hmm. We don't hear just about, you know, like, somebody's life was... great, easy, no complications, everything went smoothly and well in the Torah, because that's just not a story.
Interesting. So, I mean, I would suggest that if there was a story that was just clear-cut and positive, first of all, I don't think relationships work that way. They just, you know, not on this planet. But I also think that there would have to be something that they're doing that we would want to learn from and replicate. I mean, we'll see. We're going to learn things from Moshe and Yisro, so...
Yeah, well, we did live together for 80 years without any.
Yeah, so let's get moving here. In order to get this, we need to understand why these relationships are so fraught. If this is happening so consistently, then there has to be something driving it. And I think there are three elements that drive it. Number one, there are parents-in-law who see the child-in-law as an acquisition. I mean, Bisuel with Yitzchak's wealth is a clear-cut example of it. Laban is obviously an example of that with Yaakov. But lest you say, this is only what happens in the wicked family of Nahor, right? So Bisuel is like that, and Laban is like that. Look at the Gemara in number 8. Lekak suba de la ramu batigra. There is no ksuba that does not start a fight. And what they're talking about here is the old style ksuba, in which the amount of money that was in the ksuba was actually negotiated. It wasn't just, here's your form that you, you know, got at the Judaica store. They, but you actually debated what number was going to go in there. And the Gemara tells you that there are always fights between the sides of the family about what is fundamentally a financial issue. It's about acquisition. That's one. A second cause is when parents-in-law see the child-in-law as a, or vice versa, frankly, as a threat, whether justified or not. So Yehuda withholds Shayla from Tamar because he views Tamar as a threat. He thinks something went wrong with Aaron Onan, and he's not willing to risk Shayla at that stage. Shaul and David is an obvious example, right? Shaul perceives David not because of the marriage; it's just in general he pursues David as a threat. And then the third, and the one that's most relevant in the Moshe and Yisro conversation, is a clash of cultures. You're coming from different worlds. Rivka, Yitzchak, and the wives of Esav, right? Entirely different worldviews between the between those two sides. Manoach telling Shimshon not to marry the formerly Plishti woman. Kalba Savua disowning his daughter for marrying Rabbi Akiva. He comes from a world that's money focused, and Rabbi Akiva is, you know, this poor shepherd who's going to go study Torah. And here I come back to number 9, Rabbeinu B'chaye, from the shiur we had on Chaye Sara, where we talked about the instruction, don't marry from the daughters of Canaan. And he quoted for us the Gemara in Psachim, which people like to give in wedding divrei Torah, right? In ve'agafen, bin ve'agafen, davar na'u miskabel, right? The idea that it's good when the two families are grapes of similar vines. The why? Because this way you avoid a lot of fighting. Because they have similar background, they have a shared background, shared status. Where you can avoid the clash of cultures, you do better. And I think exploring that issue, the clash of cultures, is important because it also fuels the other two issues: the acquisition issue and the threat issue. Meaning, the if you know your values are not shared with the person who's entering the family, it fuels a lack of trust, the sense that the other one is not one of us, so my priorities will come first. Each side wanting to preserve its identity, right? Lavan says those kids are my kids, you know, that kind of thing. The problem is that, as I wrote on the sheet, we want these relationships to be good. First of all, a halachic point in source number 10. The tour writes, V'chayev l'chabed chamiv. One is obligated to honor his father-in-law. And it brings you a proof from, actually, David and Shaul. When, this is a bizarre case to bring as proof, but David is able to kill Shaul, and he doesn't. He only cuts the corner of his cloak, right? And he says to Shaul, Avi, my father, re'e gam re'e, see, look, I didn't kill you. So that's an example of being respectful. Not that he didn't kill him, but the fact that he calls him his father. The fact that he calls him father is in and of itself a sign of respect. So the... Well, that's what David did, and the tour accepts it. Is anybody blocking anything out there? Yeah, well, that's...
Parks on the other side of the street, but it's like...
Yeah, you can park on the street.
Oh,
yeah,
clearly. You think it's that?
I would guess.
Is it your car or my car?
It could be anyone's.
So the tour writes, though, that this is in fact a chiyuv. It's an obligation. Obviously, it's a good idea anyway. You want to have shalom in the household, right? I mean, you saw what we quoted in that second source, the Gemara in Erevin, about the Erev Chatzeros, and, you know, the expectation that going there for Shabbos might not mean staying there the entire day. Clearly, this, you know, you want there to be shalom, and frankly, it helps the relationship between the spouses when you don't have this kind of tension. If you take a look at source number 11, the Gemara in Moed Katan, the bottom is the Hebrew, the top of the next side has my English, where Mar Okva's brother-in-law passes away. It's his brother-in-law, and he wants to observe Shiva and Shloshim. And Rav Huna says to him, don't do that. He says, you're asking for trouble by doing that, in the sense that it's like, you know, think Ayin Hara type stuff, because the halacha is only to observe those things for one's father-in-law and mother-in-law in order to honor the spouse. Meaning, Rahman al-Itzlan, if somebody's spouse loses a parent, so there's an idea of also observing Shiva, at least in the presence of the spouse who is doing it, because it's for the honor of one's spouse. That's really the rationale.
But that's not really done. I've never seen it. You've seen it?
Yeah. So, I'm not paskening anything, and I didn't look it up before the shiur to see. This is just a line in the Gemara right now. It's not Shulchan Aruch. Marukva is one of the Amoraim.
Because
it was for his brother-in-law. And Rav Huna says to him, you don't do it for a brother-in-law. Only for a parent.
Robert, did you know you've seen people do this?
I believe I have seen it, but again, I don't want to say anything practical without looking in the Shulchan Aruch first, because I don't remember offhand, but I believe I have seen it in front of the spouse who is in Avelis.
Yeah.
So let me not say anything, because I really don't want to mislead anybody. I will believe neither include it in the follow-up email, okay? Okay, so the question here is this. How does this work for Moshe and Yisro? How do they solve this problem? So what we have here are not the problem of the clash of cultures. Right? If a clash of cultures creates such a challenge in relationships, so how is it that they manage the relationship?
He left.
So that would be one answer, is they don't see each other much, but again, they did for a very long time before that.
That was before, was Moshe even Jewish?
Let me go back a few steps. And Moshe, for the first couple of years of his life, is raised by his mother.
Egyptian.
No. First couple of years of his life, he's raised by his mother. Correct. And he knows he's Jewish. He leaves the palace and he goes and saves the Jews being beaten by the Egyptian. He knows who he is. But a few things. First of all, it's worth recognizing, and this is what I meant when I said Moshe Yisro, not necessarily, the beginning of their relationship is not necessarily such a great one. Without prison. You'll see. But take a look at source number 12. This is Rashi, that when Yisro has the girls invite Moshe home, Kiran lo v'yocha lechem, call him and he'll eat bread, Rashi says very straightforwardly, he had a shidduch on his mind. He's trying to marry off one of his daughters. That's what Yisro is looking for. It's this acquisition type thing, which becomes even stronger when you look at source number 13. You see, the Torah states that when... The Torah states that after Moshe is invited to their home, it says Vayoel Moshe Lasheves Es Ha'ish, and the word Vayoel is an odd word. Unkelus translates it as Vitzavi. It means he wanted to stay with the man. He agreed to stay with the man. However, the other meaning of Vayoel is to swear, to take a shvua, an Allah, the Aleph Lamed Hey. So the Gemara here reads it as having taken an oath. Look at number 13. Vayomer Hashem Moshe b'Midyan lech shuv Mitzrayim ki meisi kol anashim. When Hashem says to Moshe, it's time for you to go back to Egypt, all the men who were pursuing you have died. Amar lo, Hashem said to him, why did Hashem say to him, b'Midyan? What does that mean? Hashem said it to Moshe in Midyan. Why are you specifying that? B'Midyan nadarta lacha, v'hater nidracha b'Midyan. You swore in Midyan, meaning you swore you weren't going to leave. You have to go do ataras nadarim, whatever that means. In Midyan, you have to go repeal your vow, again, whatever that looks like before the Torah is given and without a Beis Din. But Moshe, you have to repeal your vow in Midyan, meaning Yisro actually made Moshe swear. Before he would let Moshe marry Tzipporah, he made him swear he's going to stay in Midyan. That's not a positive thing for an in-law relationship. I think that generally speaking, we don't like that kind of thing. And further... And most, really, take a look at number 14, a classic medrash. When Moshe says, Ger hayisi be'eretz noch briyah, I was a stranger in a foreign land, meaning Midian. So just working with my translation in the interests of time, Rabbi Yeshua says, it certainly was a foreign land to him. Right? Midian is a foreign land. Rabbi Elazar Modoi said, 2 weeks in a row, quoting Rabbi Elazar Modoi, it was a land of a foreign god. Nochriya, Nochri, Nechar, Ya, this idol. What does that mean? It was a land of a foreign god. When Moshe said to Yisro, give me your daughter Tzipora for a wife, Yisro replied, accept that which I will tell you, and I'll give it to you for a wife. And he said, I presume Tzipora was asked by someone at some point. He said, what is it? And he said, Yisro said back to him, your first son shall be for Avodah Zarah, and afterwards for Shemayim. Your first son has to be trained to worship idols. And Moshe accepted it. And Yisro said, I want you to swear to me. And he swore to him, by Yoel Moshe, Allah is an oath. And that's why the Malach comes to kill Moshe. Because Moshe has not given his son a bris milah. Moshe's son is going to be raised for Avodah Zarah. That's the way that this Medrash reports it. There's a lot to be said about this Medrash. It fits in with the Gemara Bava Basra, Daf Kuf Yud. There's a whole lot more about this. But if you ask me at this stage, the clash of cultures thing is a problem. Right?
And he wasn't pressured. He said this is what needs to be done, and he agreed.
So,
was this before Hashem revealed himself to him?
Yes.
So, I don't know why this is such a big deal. This was before Judaism. He became...
Because he's still part of us, who are slaves in Mitzrayim, who are descendants of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I have a problem with this. Yes, I do. And I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. Sorry.
I don't have a problem there, so I don't see that as negative.
No, I just meant that it shows like sort of this acquisitive sense. He wants to manipulate
and get
emotional.
It was normal for
the time.
So the netter that he made, is it? So which one is it?
So the first version of it, it's two different views. Two different views. One view is that it's just stay in Midian, and the other view is actually it's this whole other, you know, send your kid to Catholic school thing. So so how is it that the relationship improves? So first of all, Moshe is patient and adaptable. He rolls with the punches. Not only does he take the vow, but as we said, Hashem tells him, I want you to go to Yisro to nullify it. Look at the Medrash in the Sifri in source number 15. When Moshe turns to God, when he wants to make it into Eretz Canaan, he says, I want to go in. He says to Hashem, Ata chilosa laharos es avdecha es gadlecha, which literally is, you began to show your servant your greatness, right? Meaning, Hashem, you started to show me your greatness. But the word hachilosa is a very strange word. It comes from the word chol, which, again, hachilosa can be read as tchila, you started to, but it also can be read as chol. So as I wrote in the translation here, the Medrash, the Sifri, is reading it as, you have made chol, you have made mundane, meaning you lifted my vow, telling me, go take my nation Israel from Egypt. But I said before you, I can't. I have already sworn to Yisro that I will not leave him. In other words, Moshe honors the vow that he made to Yisro, even though I can't think that Moshe wants to be stuck in Midian for life. The Jews are still in Mitzrayim. But he goes along with it. And in terms of the version of the Medrash in number 14, that it's a vow about his son learning Avodah Zarah, so the Baal HaTurim says, Moshe's intent all along was to be patient, and Yisro is going to change over time. He says, Zaya Kavanaso, this was his intent, for he knew that he would bring his father-in-law to the good, as he did, Shari Nisgayer, Yisro converted. That's one of these who makes that argument. The Baal HaTurim's answer is that indeed, Yisro comes around. Moshe is patient. He doesn't expect Yisro to change for him right away. He says, right now I'm going to go along with it, and we'll see where it goes. He's also visibly respectful, right? That whole thing that we saw in the beginning of our parsha, where he goes out to greet him, he has this big feast and all of that, he listens to his counsel. And in time, Yisro comes to appreciate that which is beautiful about Klal Yisrael.
And Hashem accepts that he just has to wait.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, he's Moshe. So I sort of feel like you know, anything Moshe does automatically has the stamp unless the Torah tells me otherwise. So this isn't the chiddush, right? Telling people to deal with the clash of cultures by being patient and adaptable and respectful. Like, you know, you could read that in any self-help book.
Because he sent the malach to kill Moshe.
Well, that's right. If you take the view that sending the malach is, in fact, a response to this, which is what the Medrash is saying here, then yes, although Sipora, by doing the bris milah, somehow manages to prevent that.
So maybe she, in that respect, then brings her father along as well. Like, maybe the whole story evolves because of that.
That's interesting. I would have liked to have seen that in the Chumash. Like, something like that, that she managed to get Yisro on board with that, would have been good to see. But I hear the suggestion for sure.
Is he criticized at all for marrying Sipora? Like, should he have been avoided this whole Yisro story? Or do we say that he knew that Yisro would eventually
I haven't seen him criticized for marrying Zipporah. Other than those who may want to read Miriam's story, you know, as relating to that, in Baloska.
Right. You don't hear much about Moshe's children.
Right. So that's the part that I didn't put in here. I felt like it would be too much to throw that into this shir. But the Gemara Bava Basra Daf Kuf Yud has a discussion about Moshe's grandson going into Avodah Zarah. And some will trace that back to this medrash. Yonah's son Ben Gershom Ben Moshe, as the Gemara in Bava Basra reads it, he appears at the end of Sefer Shoftim, towards the end of Sefer Shoftim, as Yonah's son Ben Gershom Ben Menashe, but the Nun is written higher than the Mem Shin Hei, and the Gemara suggests that it's actually, since there's only one person we know of in Tanakh whose name is Yonah's son Ben Gershom, and his father is Moshe. We know that Gershom has a son named Yonah's son. It's in Dibre HaYamim. So the Gemara says this is the same person, and that's the Levi who ends up serving Pesal Micha. We don't know anything.
Because it's something I heard once that with all the great patriarchs, they all had to have coming through them something negative, and then afterwards, like Abraham, he needed to get that Abedazar piece out from Yishmael, and then he was able to have Yitzhak that would follow. And with all of the Avos, that there is some negative kind of force that comes out because it's within their genes.
Right.
And then the positive.
Right. So there is that notion that's found, the idea of Yaakov as Bechir HaAvos, and that's why he's able to have all of the Shvatim, and he has no problem, so to speak, among any of his children. Right. There is such an idea. The Sifrei Kabbalah and Hasidus really like this approach. I don't know.
So is there any new approach that the Chumash is showing about how to improve relationships?
So,
or it's all kind of given.
So, to my mind, what we're supposed to get out of this is that is simply Moshe's approach to Yisro is clearly, in our parsha, a respectful one, but also it's built up as being very patient and adaptable. And he's not, you know, trying to rush things. He's not refusing Yisro. He's not reacting harshly. Look, I think it isn't, you know, a major chiddush. I think that just seeing it in the Moshe Yisro relationship and recognizing the contrast with all the other in-law relationships that we saw is valuable. But at the end of the day, this isn't going to work everywhere. I don't think this would have saved Yaakov.
Right.
You know, Lavan doesn't become a nice guy because Yaakov is being respectful. Yaakov basically tried this.
Yeah.
Right? He did what Lavan told him to do all along and got nowhere. This isn't going to save David and Shaul. Shaul has other reasons to not like David, having nothing to do with anything David does him. Nonetheless, I think it can have value for us. So I'm just going to go through the review questions. And Das is finally cutting the cake here. Okay, review questions.
Yeah.
Three positive signs of a good social and religious relationship between Yisro and Moshe in Parshas Yisro. You have the Korbanos, the feast, and the advice that that he gives, and then Hashem approves. The four examples of bad parent-child-in-law relationships found in the Torah. We had more than four, but I'll take four. We have Rivka and Esav. Rivka slash Yitzchak and Esav. You've got Lavan and Yaakov. Whether you like the Yehuda Tamar idea or not, I leave to you. But you've got Manoah and the Plishti woman. The formerly Plishti woman, you have Shaul and David. You can pretty much take your pick. Three reasons for poor in-law relationships as found in these relationships in Tanakh. The philosophy of acquisition, the idea that the child-in-law or parent-in-law is a threat, and then the clash of cultures. Two signs that the relationship between Yisro and Moshe began poorly, so having him swear to stay, or having him swear to have his son educated non-Jewish, or, you know, Dina will disagree, but acquiring Moshe. Yeah, the which again, it's true, it was the way things were done, and not just then either. And two ways Moshe deals with the problem are, I think, the patience with Yisro going along with things, and also the respect that he shows him. So that to me is what we draw from here. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.